Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. This week, we welcome to the virtual stage of our Corona Radio Theater members from the South Bay Musical Theater who will be performing a selection from the radio play Dracula by Orson Welles. Actor and then future filmmaker Orson Welles adapted Bram Stoker's 1897 novel Dracula for the American radio drama anthology series Mercury Theater of the Air, and was first performed in July of 1938 over the Columbia Broadcasting System radio network. The timing of late October 2020, an appropriate time to hear this classic. I hope you'll stay tuned. I love to count our guests. Also, joining me from the Pear Theater in Mountain View, we talked to director Betsy Cruz Craig and actor Cynthia Lagodzinski about the production of Lysistrata, a classic Greek comedy written by Aristophanes about women enacting a sex strike to convince their husbands to end war. The play will be filmed live outdoors with an 8-woman cast and presented digitally October 16th through November 8th. Plus, we talk about the virtual adaptation of Letters to a Daughter from Prison, a play by Levon Muller based on the letters between Jawaharlal Nehru and his adolescent daughter, Indira, written between 1930 and 1942, before he became India's first prime minister. It's being presented by Bay Area-based Enact Arts, and I'll talk with founder, artistic director, and actor, Vinita Sudbilani. Well, let's start there, and welcome back to our open airwaves via Zoom rather than in person at our KLW studios, as she has been in the past, Vinita Sudbilani. Vinita has been acting since the age of 5 with both amateur and professional theater companies and has directed some 21 plays to date. Nonprofit arts management is her second career after a stint as engineer in the corporate tech world. Vinita, welcome back to Open Air.
Thank you, David. It's always fun to hang out with you.
Well, Vinita, when and how did you first learn of the playwright and Fulbright fellow, Levon Muller?
In July, as every other theater company, had to do some quick soul searching on what does a theater company do when it can't do theater in physical spaces. And so we were looking for a play that's kind of like, you know, A.R. Gurney's Love Letters, which is just letters back and forth and would make the perfect virtual Zoom production. And Denzel, who plays Nehru, had actually played Nehru in this play 30 years ago when it first opened in New York and then in Delhi. And so he suggested the play. It sounded wonderful. And then we started working on it, except it wasn't written for Zoom. So we had to go through several series of adaptations.
Well, of course, yeah, adaptations is the key word of 2020. And hopefully change is the other affirming word as this month and next progresses. Now, you mentioned the actor portraying Nehru, Denzel Smith, among many other prominent roles on the big and small screen, is no stranger to this role.
He's no stranger to this role. He's played it in this play, in several other plays. And then he's played Nehru's counterpart in the independence movement, Jinnah, who went on to become the prime minister of Pakistan when Pakistan was formed. So he's done it all. He's a history buff, and he's so passionate about this period in history that it has been a learning experience for me all the way through.
Well, speaking of history, let's get some history 101. India did not always have a prime minister. Nehru was the first. Give us a little bit of background for those that aren't up on Indian and Pakistani politics.
Okay, so cut back to 1947. In 1947, 15th August is when India was formally declared and formed as a free country, and Pakistan also came into existence in that moment. In the prior 200 years before that, we had been a British colony. So Nehru, Gandhi, Jinnah, and Lal Bahadur Shastri were the four really prominent people who, in the 20 years leading up to independence, fought what we now call the Freedom Movement, or the Swadeshi Movement, as it's called. The movement for independence. And Nehru was a very, very serious actor in it, as was Gandhi. But Gandhi is better known because he found the single way of defeating the British, which was with non-violence and non-cooperation. And so Indira Gandhi, very young Indira Gandhi at the age of 11, was a foot soldier in this non-cooperation movement. And she started her own movement for children because Nehru said, you have to be 18 to be part of the Congress Party. And she said, no, I don't. I'll just start my own party.
Well, this is obviously set against her, very much in tandem with the freedom struggle and Gandhi's nonviolent protests. How did Nehru and Gandhi become allies?
I think they were idealistically completely aligned. You know, they were deeply committed to creating a secular democratic nation. And Gandhi, as you may know, was assassinated because of his beliefs in secularism and in wanting to create religious parity in India, despite the fact that Pakistan had become a Muslim nation primarily for Muslim citizens. And so he was assassinated for that. So ideologically, they were perfectly aligned. They had a great respect for each other, and they worked in tandem, you know, right through the process. They were both went often to Britain, and both slightly not enamored of the British way, if I may say so.
And sadly, assassination figures prominently in Indian history. Now, yeah. letters from prison, how did that come about, and how long was he in prison?
So Nehru spent a total, I think, of about 14 years in prison through most of his daughter's formative years. He went to prison the first time when she was 4 years old. And he was still in prison when she turned 24, when she wanted to get married and, you know, start a life of her own. But he took a vow after he came back from prison the very first time that he would not let absence or distance in any way impact his role as a father. And so he would write to her letters and she would write back to him. And I have a book this is a compendium of all the letters which they wrote between 1922 and 1964. And it's only 600 pages long. And this is not even an exhaustive compendium of their letters. They were prolific letter writers, and they wrote about everything from the mundane to, you know, to poetry, to descriptions of clouds and green fields. But they also discussed history, economics, politics, philosophy, writers. You know, there is one letter in which he exhorts her to finish Tolstoy's War and Peace and not be intimidated by the number of pages in it. They shared a love of everything intellectual and erudite. So those letters are incredible insight into a father-daughter relationship in which a father is so nurturing and forming a child, a female child, unusual in that time, to be the best that she could possibly be, but driven completely by the ideals of, you know, he says in one letter, may you grow up to be a brave soldier in the service of your nation.
And sure enough, Indira became prime minister from January 1966 to March of 1977. And again, from January 1980 until her assassination in 1984. Now, this is a role that you're playing, obviously informed by the letters, but obviously also informed by your history and association and life.
Totally informed by my association, my life. She became prime minister in 1966. I am born in 1963.
So, me too. All right. When's your birthday before we go on?
1st of June. Is yours any close?
January. All right. We're still kindred spirits. That's all right.
Totally. So, up until the time that I turned 20, because I grew up in Kolkata, my life was bookended by two women. There was Mother Teresa on the ground, who I worked with very closely. who was my role model in engagement with community. And then the only India I knew growing up was an India run by Indira Gandhi, because I left the country in 1987. And so my concept of my country is really tied up with this larger than life presence of Indira. And she may have made some mistakes in the latter part of her prime ministership, but she did some absolutely incredible things. She brought India out of a desperate famine that had been, you know, building up from the years of British leeching of resources. And she made India an industrial powerhouse, an agriculture powerhouse, to the point where we were then exporting foodstuffs. She won two wars against Pakistan and against China. She was the woman who created Bangladesh as a separate country. And I was just in my historical research. Every South Asian country has had a female prime minister. She was, of course, the longest running prime minister and perhaps the most active on world stage. She was also very, very committed to non-alignment, you know, in a political way. And so she was really balancing relationships with Russia, China, and America without any kind of partisanship, which was a very difficult thing to do. Nixon was not a huge fan of hers for that reason.
I'm sure, yeah. Those would be some interesting letters to read or some tapes to listen to for that matter.
Nixon has a tape where, you know, he's caught, unfortunately, the tape is now public, where he's saying the most scathing things about her and about Indian women in general.
Wow. Well, this is particularly relevant both in the way this work was selected for virtual presentation and the fact, I think we all here on Zoom and in the listening audience hope, that a woman of part Indian background may well become a leader, or in this case, vice leader of the free world, for as long as we can hold on to that title here in the U.S.
Yeah, so that's actually why I brought up this small but very significant fact, actually not small, that every South Asian country, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Pakistan, India, of course, Bhutan, Nepal, every country under the South Asian banner has had female leadership, strong and efficient female leadership. So Kamala comes from a good gene stock, and it wouldn't be a bad thing to vote for her.
And indeed. I mean, it's just like America. There's nothing to be afraid of. It can only be good, as we'll learn in our next segment about Lysistrata and her great work back in Aristophanes' time. So tell us a little bit about the rest of the cast and your relationship with director Dish Marawala.
So I mentioned that Denzel has been and is a consummate actor for the last 32 years, professional actor. You know, he was last seen in Christopher Nolan's Tenet, which just released. So he's an actor of a caliber way beyond mine. And so it was a fabulous challenge to rise up to his level of acting. But he lives in Mumbai, and I'm here in California. And our director, Dish Marawala, who is an ad man, a wordsmith, but fundamentally a director of Shakespearean plays, he lives in London. And so it was an extremely interesting collaboration, because we brought together not only the challenges of, oh, what time should we rehearse, but also very, very different perspectives in terms of what are the nuances of what we should present and what would our audiences like to see more of. It was a play in development, script-wise, right until the final take. So...
Mm-hmm. And more on Dish. You've worked with Dish before, Marawala.
Dish Marawala, he's the director. He's like I said, he's more of a Shakespearean director. He's also a film actor, and he ran his own theater company. He has lived here in Chicago and Colorado. He has lived in Bengaluru in India, where he ran his own theater company, and now he's working in London. And he has a understanding of theater that is completely 360 degrees. You know, he works, he's in writing, of course, and in directing, but he's been seen in many, many roles in theater as well as in film. So really very inspiring group of men to work for. And I want to give them a shout out publicly for never mansplaining. In my corporate career, I've had to put up with that several times when we've been working where I've been, you know, really a wonderful duo to work with. Yes.
That's encouraging. The performances of Letters to a Daughter from Prison will be filmed and edited, complete with a music soundtrack in advance for streaming through Zoom, October 23rd to 25th. So tell us, in a nutshell, what else an act is working towards?
Before I do that, I want to give a shout out to my creative director, Rashina Humayu, who all of us have had family that worked in the freedom movement, and her grandfather went to jail many times. So she was a creative director. So when you see the final product, it will be her baby. What's coming up next at Enact? We have another collaboration coming up with Rage Theatre in Bombay. They've been around for about 30 years, and we put out a call for playwrights to write plays about the COVID situation. And we've picked 7 out of the 37 plays that were submitted, and we are in the process of creating a new play festival on COVID plays.
Interesting. All right. Well, learn more at enact.org. That's ENACTE.org. More details and tickets at eventbrite.com as well. Links to all of this at our website, klw.org. Just search for any of the words or names you've heard today, or better yet, peruse all of our recent shows at the Open Air link. Vinita Sudbalani, I wish you a terrific performance and continued success at Enact. Thanks so much for being with us again.
Thank you, David, and all the best to the other participants.
Cheers. Still to come on Open Air, we'll be hearing from our Corona Radio Theater participants from the South Bay Musical Theater, and a timely production of an extended excerpt from Orson Welles' radio drama Dracula. But next, drama of a different and ancient sort, with the classic Greek comedy Lysistrata by Aristophanes. It's a play about women putting on a sex strike to convince their husbands to end the Peloponnesian War between Greek city-states, and was originally performed in Athens in 411 BC, now adapted for the Pear Theater in Mountain View by Carolyn Balducci. While many of the play's themes have remained as relevant as they were in Aristophanes' time, the pair will also take the opportunity to explore the breadth of what gender means today in this particular production. Lysistrata uncovers the power of sex, the personal sacrifices some will make for the sake of peace, and the hilarity that can come from it all. What would you do? Or not do, AA, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, for peace in our time. Let's talk with director Betsy Cruz Craig and actor Cynthia Ladgodzinski about the production. It's a pleasure to welcome Betsy back to Open Air. Betsy recently relocated to Tucson, Arizona, where she continues her work in the theater world after 8 years working in the Bay Area Theater as an actor, director, and former artistic director of the pair. Welcome back, Betsy.
It's wonderful to be here.
Nice to see you too via Zoom. I wish we could have a hug in person, but maybe down the road, or if you've got a guest room in Tucson, maybe I'll swing by sometime.
I do. Come on down.
Well, I didn't realize this, but thanks to the pair's educational mission and comprehensive program notes for the production by Susan Pettit, Aristophanes is the only ancient Greek comic playwright whose works have come down to us. And yet we only have 11 of the 40 or so plays he wrote.
I know, it's very interesting, and it's funny to me because he takes jabs at some of the other famous playwrights of the time in his plays. It's very funny because I think maybe because he was a humorist, because he was a comedic playwright, I think he wasn't as well respected at the time. And it's he does. You can find little tidbits, little jabs, little pokes at Aeschylus and so forth throughout the pieces. I think it's funny. It's like he was saying,
"Oh, everyone pokes fun at Aeschylus. Come on,
yes, exactly, Euripides.
What's not to make fun of him, Euripides? Oh, my. Well, another fun fact, and also relative to our time, at the time of Aristophanes' writing of the play, Athens was in decline. Perhaps as many as a third of its inhabitants had died in a plague that lasted for 4 years, from 430 to 426 BC, resulting in economic crises and distrust of the democratic government. Sound familiar? Now, I've always thought of comparing our own American empire to the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, but perhaps, and alas, we should turn to ancient Greece instead.
Yeah, it's interesting. And this play for me, it's interesting. I've played the title role and I've also directed it in the past about, gosh, almost 20 years ago. And it's funny how it's in a cycle, it's cyclical. It comes back to me every, 10 to 20 years and it makes itself known. This piece for me is incredibly timely, and it's not just, the advent of the Me Too movement, but I think it's more than just the female voice that's relevant. It's about coming together around a common cause, the empowerment of the collective. And I thought it would be really interesting to explore doing this piece at this time. It wasn't my intention at all to do it with a cast of eight and all women, but because of the nature of COVID and the limitations that we had in terms of number of casts, we said, why don't we just try it? And had the eight women play all the roles, which usually in a full scale production would be 25 to 40 people. So there's a lot of challenges in doing it this way, but I think that what we did with all of the best intentions, and we already did it. We filmed it, we edited it, we filmed it outside in the Paratheater parking lot. And everybody had to be social distanced. We had one actor who really didn't feel comfortable being on set with the other cast members. So we recorded all of her pieces separately. And so there were a lot of challenges. And even in spite of that, this wonderful collection of women that we brought together for this piece, everyone was so happy to be working and working on a piece that they believed in, that it will certainly go down as a memory, in a professional memory and a personal memory for the rest of my life. I'm really happy that we were able to continue and see it through to the end. So.
Well, speaking of those challenges, let's give a shout out to the production and post-production crew that are making this possible.
Right. St. John Jones, who became the artistic director when I stepped down in January, and a huge shout out to St. John, who's had to deal with absolutely everything that an artistic director,
not what he expected to inherit, that's for
not
sure.
Not what and not what I expected to leave. Just, it's interesting, the timing, but he is also a filmmaker and editor and spent countless hours putting this piece together. I think that theater is a difficult thing to film, right? And there's so much controversy around creating theater in the Zoom world, rather, or do we, do a play outside and stream it live? Do we do what we did, which was record a play like a film and edit it together? But I think that what everybody has to understand is that the fact that we've got incredibly talented theater artists that are still, desperately committed to keeping this art form alive is so admirable. And I think in whatever shape or form we do it, I'm so pleased to see the plethora of artists that are, finding new solutions to all of these incredible questions that keep popping up. Mm-hmm. So yes, shout out to St. John and to the pair in general for continuing their work through all of these challenges.
And the challenges that he's going to be facing battling AB5 here in California.
That was the other thing that happened, right when he took over. And it's just, like I said, hurdle after hurdle. It's kind of crazy. I work for a theater.
Don't get too settled in Tucson.
I know, right? I know. There's a lot of great work happening here in very innovative ways. I work for a theater called The Invisible that has an 89-seat house that is open. They're doing Trumbo right now, the play about Dalton Trumbo, and they're opened at 20% capacity, right? Socially distanced. The actors come in full makeup. They don't share a dressing room. It's just always trying to find new solutions, right? And I don't think that we're headed in any other direction but that for some time.
For a while, indeed.
Yeah.
Well, let's go back to Lysistrata and turn to the title character from the woman who portrays her in the play, Cynthia Ladgodzinski, a Livermore native who works around the Bay Area as an actor and director. She's been seen in pair productions as well as with Silicon Valley Shakespeare, Livermore Shakespeare Festival, and our friends at the Hill Barn Theater, among others. Welcome, Cynthia.
Thank you, David.
Nice Tell us here. About Lysistrata. You're documenting and playing the first documented feminist.
Well, you know, I went to UC Santa Cruz. I got a feminism bent. So I had a great time doing this show. One of my dear friends from school did this play when I was in college. And so I had a great time being able to be inside of it and reminisce about our time together with her via this show. So I was very thankful and excited when Betsy called me in for an audition and cast me as it. It's been a wonderful thing to do.
So were you familiar with the ancient Greek character prior to this production via your extensive UC Santa Cruz education? Or was this an it's all Greek to me moment for you?
No. So my housemate and one of my dear friends, she directed this when we were both grad students and directing at UC Santa Cruz. And so I was very familiar with what kind of props would be strapped onto the men and what it would look like and what the subject matter was. And we performed it outdoors in the Redwood Glen at UC Santa Cruz, and we had it was a beautiful show. I wasn't in it. I was doing something else for my thesis, and so it was exciting to see what she had been so excited about, and I can definitely see her in the show quite a bit, which is lovely. So, yeah, I am familiar with some Greek stuff. I think doing Greek comedies is – it's my first Greek comedy. I've only ever done Greek tragedies before. And it's very interesting. It's a lot of fun. It's different. And I love hearing when he starts to mock his contemporaries. I love hearing and speaking what he's talking about and how he's making fun of some of the other playwrights of his time. I love that. I mean, it's pretty funny.
Now, as Lysistrata, you persuade the women of Athens to take a long and detailed oath in which women abjure all their sexual pleasures, at least with men, which even includes apparently the lioness on the cheese grater, apparently a sexual position at the time. Are there any cheese graters involved in this production?
We don't have any cheese graters involved, although I must say that there was one camera shot that length of the phallus that was on the character at the time, which I thought was hysterically funny. And there were no cheese graters, no. In fact, because we're in COVID times, our ability to do anything other than verbal repartee was, you know, severely limited.
And so, I think that I have to point out that one of the phalluses actually has marks on it of it six feet apart. And I'm wondering how many viewers actually caught the fact that the phallus is like a great big yardstick.
Well, now I'm really intrigued. Okay. A socially distanced 6 foot phallus, all yours coming your way at thebear.org. Now, other than the pretext of withholding sex, where does Aristophanes insert what we'd call comedic content?
The real leaders of the comedy in this piece are the head of the old man's and old woman's chorus. And that battle of the sexes it sort of frames the entire piece. And we follow these two main characters in sort of like intermittent bits throughout the piece. Because there's actually some very, Lysistrata has some very serious and passionate speeches throughout the piece in terms of a call to end the war and how the women have felt about it, watching their fathers, their husbands, their sons die for decades and decades. But the old man and the old women's chorus, it's classic. It's the age old battle of the sexes, right? And the one upsmanship that this pair has throughout the piece is wonderful. And it's really the biggest comic force in the piece.
Nice. Remind me of when we can witness this production.
It's on now. You can buy a ticket at www.thepair.org. And it is streaming, I believe, through November 16th. I think you probably got that information, David. But I
do. I'll have to review it. We'll make sure it's at our website. But go to thepair.org for more information. Betsy Cruz Craig, Cynthia Ladgodzinski, thanks so much for taking some time with us today on Open Air.
Pleasure's all mine. And wonderful to see you and all of the other Bay Area artists. Thank you so much.
Cheers, and I look forward to seeing the production. Well, and now for our timely late October edition of Corona Radio Theater that we've started as an initiative here on Open Air to allow some actors to do some live radio theater, and an extended excerpt from Orson Welles' radio adaptation of Dracula, originally for his infamous Mercury Radio Theater on the Columbia Broadcasting Network back in 1938. We welcome actors from the South Bay Musical Theater Troupe, Michael Paul Hirsch as Jonathan Harker, Jay Steele as Dracula, Barbara Henninger as Van Helsing, Jenny Chapman as Lucy Westerna, and Sarah Dean as Arthur Seward.
Mercury Theater on the Air presents Orson Welles' own version of Bram Stoker's great novel, Dracula.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Arthur Seward. I am here to bear witness to the truth of certain events, which you may find it hard to believe, but I ask you believe them. I have here certain documents, telegrams, clippings from the press of the day, memoranda and letters in various hands. All needless matters have been eliminated, and they stand forth as simple fact. I present to you first with excerpts of the private journal of Jonathan Harker.
I, Jonathan Harker, lawyer's clerk, articles to Peter Hawkins, Esquire of Exeter, England, am writing this journal in the hope that if misfortune overtakes me, it may one day come to the eyes of those who love me. I set out from London on the last day of April to visit one of our clients in Eastern Europe. On May the 3rd, I arrived in Budapest and came after nightfall to Klausenburg on the border of Transylvania. At Bistritz, there was a letter of welcome for me from our client informing me that his carriage would await me at the Borgo Pass. It was signed Dracula. The road was rough, but still we seemed to fly over it with a feverish haste. When it grew dark, there seemed to be some excitement among the passengers. They kept speaking to the driver and looking at me and urging him on with greater speed. The mountains seemed to come nearer to us on either side. Coachman! Coachman, what is it? Where are we?
You're nearing your destination, young hare. This is the Borgo Pass.
There are black, rolling clouds overhead, and in the air, the heavy, oppressive scents of thunder. It was within a few minutes of midnight. The wind was rising, moaning and whistling through the rocks, and the branches of the trees crashed together as we swept along. It was colder and colder still, and fine, powdery snow began to fall. The baying of wolves sounded nearer and nearer, as if though they were closing round on us from every side. We kept on ascending, always ascending. The howling of wolves was growing less. And presently, it ceased altogether. And just then, the moon broke through the black clouds, and by its light, I saw around us a ring of wolves running alongside the carriage in silence, with white teeth and lolling red tongues, with long, sinewy limbs and shaggy hair.
Welcome to my house.
I must have fallen asleep. The carriage had pulled up in the courtyard of a vast, ruined castle. The coachman was nowhere to be seen.
Welcome to my house. Come freely. Go safely and leave something of the happiness you bring.
Count Dracula.
I am Dracula.
The face was strong, very strong, aquiline. The mouth, so far as I can see it under the heavy moustache, was fixed and rather cruel-looking, with peculiarly large, sharp, white teeth.
You hear them, Mr. Harker?
The wolves.
The children of the night. As you say, Mr. Harker, the wolves. Listen. Come, now. There are many things you must tell me tomorrow, of England and of the estate there you have purchased for me.
Ah, yes.
The estate is called Carfax, I believe.
Yes, that's so.
But now, I will detain you no longer. You will find your room in readiness, and I advise you not to leave it during the night.
This castle is on the very edge of a terrible precipice. A stone falling from the window would fall 1,000 feet without touching anything. I explored. There are doors. Doors, doors everywhere. All of them locked. The door to the great hall. The door to the courtyard. Every door in the castle is closed. Bolted against me. Castle Dracula's a prison, and I am a prisoner. The next night, I could not sleep. So, after a few hours, I got up and, lighting my candle, I placed my shaving mirror on the dressing table and was just beginning to shave.
You feel rested, Mr. Harker.
I had not seen him, although the reflection of the glass covered the whole room behind me. I turned to the glass again. Count Dracula was close to me, and I could see him over my shoulder, but there was no reflection of him in the mirror. It was blank. I started and cut myself on the side of the throat. The blood was trickling down my neck.
The blood! The blood! Wipe the blood from your face, Mr. Harker. And take care how you cut yourself. It is more dangerous than you think in this country.
When I awoke, I found most of my things were gone. My passport, my notes, my letter of credit. I could find no trace of them anywhere. And my door was locked from the outside. Count Dracula!
Yes, my young friend.
Well, what of me? When am I free? When can I leave this place?
Free? Mr. Harker, you are always free. You want to leave? Would you like to leave tonight?
Yes. Yes, in God's name.
My dear young friend, not an hour shall you wait in my house against your will. Come, follow me. Your door seems to be bolted. How strange your door is locked.
In God's name, open it!
As you will, Mr. Harker. You English have a proverb which is very close to my heart. Welcome the coming, speed departing guests. Good night, Mr. Harker.
Shut the door! Shut the door! Shut the door!
The door is shut, Mr. Harker. I take it you will remain.
Morning, June the 30th. These may be my last words I ever write in this diary. God preserve my sanity. I have never seen Count Dracula by day. At sunrise, at the first cock crow, he is gone. I don't understand these things. I only know that the wolves are baying, and that he is a man with hair on the palms of his hands, with sharp teeth and no blood in his face. He casts no shadow. He cannot be seen in a glass. And he moves like a bat across the sheer face of the castle walls. He eats no food and is mortally afraid of the crucifix. As I write this, I hear in the courtyard the rolling of heavy wheels and the cracking of whips. And there is, in the passageway below, a pound of heavy boxes being set down, boxes shaped like coffins, and I know what they hold. The boxes are filled with the holy earth from the chapel beneath the castle. The last box being nailed down. The door is shut and the chains rattle. In the courtyard and down the rocky way, the roll of heavy wheels, the cracks of whips. Help! 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 The wagons have gone. I'm alone in the castle. I'm alone in the castle. I'm alone in the castle. I'm alone. I'm alone. I'm alone.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Dr. Seward. Mr. Harker's journal terminates at this point. I now present into evidence a clipping dated of August that year from the Yorkshire Telegraph from my correspondence in Whitby. One of the greatest storms on record was experienced here today. The weather has been somewhat sultry, but Saturday evening was fine. The winds went away entirely in the evening, and there was dead calm. The only sail noticeable was a foreign schooner under full canvas, and that was seemingly going westward. A little after midnight came a strange sound from over the sea. High overhead, the air began to carry a strange, faint, hollow booming. Then, without warning, the tempest broke, and there, with all sails set, was the foreign schooner rushing with terrific speed toward the shore. A searchlight was turned on her, and there, lashed to the helm, was a corpse with a drooping head. A moment later, she crashed. At the very instant she touched, a huge dog sprang up from the deck below and, running forward, jumped onto the sand and vanished into the night. The Coast Guard, going abroad at dawn, found the dead man fastened to the spoke of a wheel. Tightly clutched in one hand was a crucifix. The man must have been dead for quite 2 days. In the pocket of the dead man's coat was a bottle, fully corked, containing a roll of paper. This proved to be an addendum to the ship's log, and there was found on board only a small amount of cargo of that most unusual nature. Apparently, the ship carried nothing but earth, common earth, packed away in wood boxes, shaped much like coffins.
Log of the Demeter, Russian flag, Black Sea to Whitby, July 6th. Finished taking in cargo, a queer cargo, boxes of earth. At noon, set sail. East wind, fresh. Crew, 4 hands, 2 mates, cook, and myself, captain. July 11th, entered Bosphorus. At dark, passed through Dardanelles. Mate reported in morning that one of the crew, Viadin, was missing. August 4th, I am all alone on my ship. And still the fog. I dare not go below. I dare not leave my helm. So here all night I stayed. And in the dimness of the night, I saw it. I saw him. God forgive me. But the mate was right to jump overboard.
It was better to die like a sailor in the blue water. But I am captain, and I must not leave my ship. I have tied my hands to the wheel when my strength begins to fail, and along with them I shall tie that which I dare not touch, my crucifix. I am growing weaker. The night is coming on. God and the Blessed Virgin help a poor ignorant soul trying to do his duty.
Telegram, Seward, Perfleet to Van Helsing, Amsterdam. Lucy Westenra in alarming condition. Cannot diagnose. Come at once. Seward.
Telegram. Van Helsing, Amsterdam to Seward. Poor fleet. I am on my way to you. Please arrange for me to examine your patient immediately on my arrival. Van Helsing.
Ladies and gentlemen, I shall now explain that 6 months before the events recorded here, I had become engaged to Lucy Westenra. We were to be married in the spring. My old teacher, Professor Van Helsing, arrived at 4 the next afternoon. I took him at once to Lucy's house. She lay in her bed asleep. She was ghastly, chalky pale. The red had seemed to have gone from even her lips and gums, and the bones of her face stood out.
Your miss is bad, very bad. She must have blood or she will die. She is not anemic. The qualitative analysis of her blood is quite normal condition. It is strange. I do not like to think how strange. Look! My God! Her throat! Look!
The black velvet band that she always wore dragged up a little and showed a red mark on her throat. Just over the external jugular vein were two punctures, not large, but not wholesome looking. The edges were white and worn looking. Well, well, what is it, Professor? What's wrong with her? Speak frankly. You can tell me the worst.
I wish I could, Seward. I wish I could, but I do not dare.
But you won't tell me anything.
I will tell you this. Your young lady is in a danger greater than death. You must believe me. If you leave her for one moment and harm befalls, you will not sleep easy thereafter.
September 8th. I sat up all night with Lucy.
Arthur, I'm afraid.
My dear, you can sleep tonight. I'm here watching you. Nothing can happen, and I promise, at any sign of bad dreams, if I see anything, I'll wake you at once.
You will? Will you really? Then I'll sleep.
I sat all night by her side. She did not wake once during the night, although something slapped most angrily against the window pane. September 11th, still quoting from my private journals. This time I received a message from Perfleet. It read, 10:20 p.m., St. John's Hospital, serious complications, case 891. Your immediate presence in London, imperative. I had no choice. Sometime later, a paper was found among Lucy's belongings.
I write this and leave it to be seen so that no one may get into trouble from me. I went to bed as usual, taking care that the window was closed as Dr. Van Helsing had directed. About 2 in the morning, I awakened. I went to the door, called out, Arthur! Arthur! There was no answer. Something's broken the window. I'm in the room alone. I dare not go out. The house seems to be empty. The air full of specks floating, circling in the draught from the window. The light burns blue, dim. What am I to do? Something very sweet and very bitter all around me, like I'm sinking into deep water. There's singing in my ears.
You shall be flesh of my flesh, blood of my blood.
Ah!
September 12th, late. Only resolution and habit can make me can let me make an entry tonight. We found her sprawled on the floor, and there was a draft in the room from the broken window. The throat was bare, showing the two wounds looking horribly white and mangled.
We are too late, my friend. We have failed. God's will be done.
Is she dying?
Yes, she's dying. Stay beside her. It will make much difference, mark me, whether she dies conscious or in her sleep.
It was late in the afternoon before she opened her eyes.
Arthur! Oh, my love, I'm so glad you've come.
I took her hand and knelt beside her. Her breath came and went like a tired, peaceful child. And then the light from the setting sun fell on her face. And then insensibly, a strange change came over her. Her eyes grew suddenly dull and hard. Her breathing was heavy. Her mouth opened and the pale gums drawn back made the teeth look large and sharp.
Arthur, oh, my love, I'm so glad you've come. Kiss me. Bend down and kiss me.
Run for your life! Run for your living soul and hers!
Lucy!
She's dead.
Poor girl. Lie in peace at last. The end.
Not so. It is only the beginning. Wait and see.
Westminster Gazette, September 25th. A Hampstead mystery. The Kensington Horror and The Woman in Black are vividly recalled to mind by a series of events that have taken place recently in the neighbourhood of Hampstead. Several cases have occurred of young children straying from home or failing to return from playing on the heath. In all these cases, the children have given as their excuse that they have been with a beautiful lady who offered them chocolates. In each case, the child was found to be slightly torn or wounded in the throat. The wound seemed to be such as might be made by a rat or a small dog.
The Hampstead Horror. Another child injured by the beautiful lady. We have just received intelligence that another child, missed last night, was only discovered late in the morning. It has the same tiny wound in the throat. Well, Seward, what do you think of that? You mean to tell me, my friend, that you still have no suspicions as to what poor Lucy died of?
Nervous prostration following a great loss or waste of blood.
And how was the blood lost or wasted? You are a clever man, my friend, and a good doctor, but you do not believe that there are things that you cannot understand. You are wrong, Seward. Are you aware of how on some islands of the Western Seas there are bats which hang on trees all day, and then, when the sailors sleep on deck because it is hot, sweep out down on them, and then in the morning are found dead men, as white as Miss Lucy was?
I understand none of these things.
After tonight, Seward, if you dare to come with me, perhaps then you will understand.
September 29th, before dawn. Now it is done, and I would sooner die 1,000 deaths than to live again what I did this night.
We will spend the night, you and I, here in this churchyard where Miss Lucy is buried. We enter the tomb.
And then?
We open the coffin. You shall yet be convinced that...
Take care, Van Helsing.
Miss Lucy is dead, is it not so? Then there can be no wrong to her. But if she's not dead...
With some difficulty, we found the tomb. I took up my place behind a yew tree on one side of the tomb, Van Helsing on the other. I was chilled and frightened. And suddenly I saw something moving between two yew trees, a dim white figure which held something at its breast. The figure stopped. I could not see the face, for it was bent down over what I saw to be a fair-haired child. There was a sharp little cry, such as a child gives in its sleep. Then the thing saw us. She drew back with an angry snarl. Her lovely, blood-stained mouth drew to a square. If ever a face meant death, I saw it that moment. Then suddenly she turned and vanished in the direction of the tomb.
The child is unharmed. We leave him in a safe place. There's a police find him. There's more to do. Come.
Now we are in the tomb. There in the coffin the thing lay, like a nightmare of Lucy. The pointed teeth, the blood-stained mouth. Van Helsing never looked up. From his bag he took out a book, his operating knife, a heavy hammer, and a round wooden stake, 2 or 3 inches thick, sharpened to a fine point and hardened over the fire.
Seward, the life of this unhappy woman has just begun. Then she becomes what you call undead. There comes with a change the curse of immortality. She cannot die, but must go on age after age, adding new victims, because all that die from the preying of the undead become themselves undead and prey on others. But if this lady, this undead, be made to rest as true dead, then the soul of the poor lady whom we love should be again free.
Tell me, what am I to do?
Take this stake in your left hand, the hammer in your right.
Yes.
Place the point over the heart.
Here?
Then I begin the prayer for the dead. In God's name, strike! Are you ready? Now, Domini des a prieste. My friends, there are such things as vampires. Had I known at first what now I know, one so precious a life would have been spared for the many of us who love her. The vampire, which is amongst us, is himself so strong that he can direct all the elements, the storms, the fog, the thunder. He can command all the meaner things, the moth and bat, the owl, the fox, and the wolf. How then are we to begin our stride to destroy him? How shall we find his place? And having found it, how can we destroy? My friends, it is a terrible task that we undertake. To fail here is not mere life or death. If we fail, we become as him, foul things of the night, as him. What do you say?
South Bay Musical Theater troupe member Jay Steele was Dracula. Michael Paul Hirsch was Jonathan Harker. Barbara Henninger was Van Helsing. Jenny Chapman performed Lucy Westenra. And Sarah Dean was Arthur Seward as part of our live Corona Radio Theater Initiative here on Open Air and your local public radio station, KALW. A full version of Dracula, written and adapted by Stephen Waffen, is in rehearsals right now at the South Bay Musical Theater and will be performed for the community on, even more appropriately, October 30th at 8 p.m. and the 31st at 7 p.m. Free tickets and more information are at southbaymt.com. Links at our website as well. I'm also pleased to thank SBMT's executive director, Sarah Dean, who provided the sound effects for this production, and to all the actors that made this drama come back to life. We appreciate your skills and being a part of Corona Radio Theater. And if you're a fan of theater, tomorrow night on LA Theater Works at 8, The Best Man by Gore Vidal, former Secretary of State Bill Russell, running for president against a candidate who will stop at nothing to defeat him. And while Russell struggles to master the art of spin, a mysterious source emerges to discredit his rival. Tomorrow night at 8, The Best Man by Gore Vidal. I'm David Latulippe. Thanks so much for listening to Open Air. Our shows are archived at kalw.org. You can send me an email, david@kalw.org, if you've got a suggestion for a future segment. My thanks to Neil Swinkles for producing the show, all on a volunteer basis, and to Damian D. Miner in the KLW studios for running the board and making this Zoom call possible. Tune in next week for our It's our first of two installments of Tales of the Resistance from the San Francisco Mime Troupe as part of our Corona Radio Theater Initiative. That and other guests, including our regular contributor, Peter Robinson. Join me then, won't you? Thank you. This is 91.7 KALW San Francisco, online at klw.org.